And in the unlikely but possible event of a problem, it will not spread to the surrounding environment, as is the case with mine accidents. This is the third component. This third element was criminally ignored in Soviet nuclear energy, precisely because the pace had to be quite fast, because 10 years had been lost. In all fairness, many Soviet Union specialists cried out and spoke out loudly against the development of nuclear power stations without containment. In particular, corresponding member of the USSR Academy of Sciences, Viktor Alexeyevich Sidorenko, was arguing that containments were required in his dissertation thesis and then in his book, based on this doctoral thesis, by all methods accessible to him at the time. However, the expert's point of view was not properly considered. There is another specific circumstance. Nuclear energy in the Soviet Union emerged not from the energy sector, but from the nuclear industry, where highly trained and disciplined personnel were used, and where special military acceptance was in place for every piece of equipment. And as a result, reliability in the sphere of nuclear industry was very high, both from a personnel and equipment standpoint. This industry's 15 to 20 years of experience has shown that competent, reliable, and precise operation of nuclear facilities, technical means of ensuring safety, and proper staff training are sufficient to prevent major accidents with radiation outbursts from occurring, at least not at the station themselves. It was not anticipated that the conditions would alter dramatically as nuclear plants transitioned from a narrow industrial context to widespread use in civil nuclear energy. Simply from the most fundamental probability calculations, the ever-increasing number of nuclear power plants raises the possibility of mistakes in people activities or problems in the operation of technological devices. So, in my opinion, enabling stations to operate without an external localization shelter was a philosophical error, and this was a crucial mistake. When did this mistake start to be corrected? Since the Soviet Union initially entered the overseas market and began building the first nuclear power plant for a foreign country, Finland. After studying worldwide experience, the Finnish side required as a customer, and by this time, an international standard had arisen, demanding precisely the three parts of safety: a dependable reactor, reliable operation, and necessary confinement. The Finns wanted the third component. As a result, the Finnish station was built with a cover. The ice evaporated as a result of this. The energy leadership began to see the significance of this factor, albeit without completely comprehending the gravity of the situation, and our development teams began to experiment with these containments. The second effect of the delay in nuclear energy development was a lack of production capacity. For instance, VVER reactor shells. It is still the most popular type of reactor on the planet, and its design and functioning may incorporate not just our personal experience, but also the experience of the entire global community. As a result, the machine building facilities lacked the capability to create the shells and the other VVER reactor equipment in sufficient quantities. This is when a segment of the energy sector made a suggestion: create a parallel branch in nuclear energy that would allow building sufficiently powerful reactors without using the shell concept, without burdening the machine building industry with the complex technology for manufacturing highly reliable reactor shells that are required for VVER reactors, so as not to limit the plans to introduce new nuclear power capacities and considering the overload of the machine building industry. This is how the concept of a channel type RBMK reactor with graphite blocks arose. If the ideology that mandated a containment over any form of nuclear plant had been created, RBMK, with its geometry and construction as a device, would have simply not existed. It would be, so to speak, outside of international norms and laws. It would not appear, no matter how dependable or wonderful it was in other aspects. However, because the nuclear energy leadership at the period did not accept this necessary containment ideology, the RBMK reactor did appear. This is why, in my opinion, the genesis of the Chernobyl accident must be traced back to the halt in nuclear energy growth in the late 1950s and early 1960s. After constructing the first nuclear facility, we paused the development of their technology, taking into account all of the safety considerations associated with the operation of these devices, and then we began to speed. And this haste necessitated the production of additional devices at the same cost. There was a need to save money. We began to save money on containments. And when containment became optional, the desire to develop another reactor line that would benefit the country without overburdening the machine building sector emerged. This is how the RBMK reactor's philosophy emerged. And this no containment approach, in my opinion, is a fundamental error of the Soviet nuclear energy. Not even Soviet nuclear energy, because nuclear energy experts, I repeat, not everyone, not unanimously, but on a broad front, spoke out against this type of reactor, both for reasons of safety and lack of containment, which is also a safety issue. Already the first launch of this reactor in the first RBMK unit of the Leningrad nuclear power plant shown that such a wide active zone, implemented in the manner that it was incredibly challenging for the operator. During the earliest launches of the first unit at the Leningrad nuclear power station, there was an issue with the neutron flow instability and difficulties managing them. This has to be done on the fly. To make it simpler to manage the reactor, the degree of fuel enrichment and a variety of other technological steps have to be implemented. Nonetheless, even with these measures, and all Soviet Union scientists recognize this from a control standpoint, this reactor required a lot of attention from the operator and was always highly complex. Furthermore, from the standpoint of international and commonly accepted safety regulations, the mere existence of this RBMK device was prohibited. However, at the least, three serious design flaws were discovered in this device. The first design flaw was failing to include at least two emergency protection systems, as required by the international regulations and basic sense. Furthermore, one of the emergency protection systems should be based on a distinct set of physical principles than the other. More crucially, in my opinion, one of the two systems must function independently of the operator. This means, let's say, one emergency protection system must be controlled by the operator automatically, semi-automatically or manually, depending on the mode, and the second emergency protection system must work independently, whatever the circumstances of the operator may be, based only on an increase in parameters, say neutron flow, power, temperature, etc., and must automatically shut down the reactor. The RBMK reactor was not equipped with such a second protection system that was operator independent and not part of the control system. This was a big mistake, and had it not been made, the Chernobyl accident would not have happened. And finally, the third design mistake, which is hard to explain, was that all the numerous emergency protection systems were accessible to the station staff. For example, there were no special double ciphers to turn off the protection systems, where protection could be disabled only by using a double or even triple command, by an operator turning a key, by simultaneous turning a key by, say, the shift supervisor, and maybe even by someone specifically responsible for safety. By a simultaneous turning of a key by the head of the station, the chief engineer, or his deputy. Such technical means and devices, which are generally used in many military systems, in missile complexes, in nuclear weapons, had not been used. This, of course, seems surprising and strange. As previously stated, the RBMK device is difficult to run because instabilities, which are theoretically possible and occur often in its operating modes, emphasizing the importance of having simulators near every RBMK device. These simulators would enable for a continual training of workers to respond appropriately when there is a variation from regular functioning. However, there were no simulators available for this particular device. However, it should be noted that a number of obstacles with this reactor were successfully overcome. For example, a number of advantages of this device are already known, such as the ability to construct a device without using machine building industry capacities. I mean the absence of a casing for the reactor, the ability to refuel the reactor while in operation allowed for having a high coefficient of power utilization in this reactor, the channel principle itself of this reactor, and a number of other technical decisions, like pumps, that were highly reliable in this reactor. These were small advantages, of course, but nevertheless. Also, the fundamental lack of containment, as practice has shown, cannot be compensated by the tightly sealed compartments, and this issue turned out to be a principle. Of course, it should be noted that the positive reactivity coefficient in this device was unforeseen by the physicists. This was tied to the first reactor, the haste with the requirement for rapid development of nuclear devices. Because in theory, with a suitable graphite arrangement and less volume introduced into the zone, this graphite inhibitor would, of course, keep the vapor coefficient within permitted limits. As practice has demonstrated, the totality of the steps implemented for this reactor have resulted in a vapor coefficient of no more than 1 beta. And this number is already highly manageable, allowing any process to be managed with adequate rapid protective devices. However, this had never been done before, and the device was designed to function with positive reactivity coefficients considerably greater than a beta in the first place. Second, in actuality, what was calculated proved to be substantially more than what was allowed for, since physical understanding of this device was still insufficient. This is a set of circumstances that led to the problem I wanted to discuss. So it's not about the operators. Of course, the mistakes made by the operators are well known, and there is no need to list them yet again. These mistakes themselves are monstrous. The actions of the station management are very hard to explain. Punishing the direct culprits of this disaster is correct, because the actions did not meet regulatory requirements and showed inconsistency with the job requirement of the people who were acting in this situation. But still, this is the fault of the officials. But the main reason is not even the errors in the design of the reactor, which of course had their place, and for which probably the respective specialists will have to answer. But the main reason is the violation of the basic safety principle for such devices. The lack of, and the unprompted removal, of the third element, placing dangerous devices in a kind of mandatory capsule that would limit the possibility of activity leaving the station or the device itself. This is the main reason for the magnitude of the accident. This is the thesis I want to be developed when we talk about the causes of the accident. The next thesis relates to the particular specification of the design of the device, the defects in this design, and the sequential description of the causes that led to the accident itself. First of all, it must be noted that this is an experiment that should have not been performed at a nuclear power plant, because the value of turbine cost down at idle is something that should be measured on a special stand built by the designer of the turbine. And I want this to be underlined. Exactly there is where this question had to be experimentally verified. But it was not. This is what forced the station management, apparently out of good intentions, to perform the experiment in the first place. Secondly, the absence of systematic thinking on the part of the station management involved with this case. When the first experiments in 1982 and 1983 showed that during a coast down, the turbine does not maintain the necessary electrotechnical parameters to serve the station's own needs, nobody even thought about solving the problem from the other side, more precisely reducing the time needed for the backup diesel generators to start and output at the required levels. But they went in a direction of increasing the cost down time of the turbine, when, at this time, there already were diesel generators that could output at the required electrotechnical levels 2 to 3 times quicker than those installed at a Chernobyl station. The most straightforward procedure would have been to replace the diesel generators at the Chernobyl power plant with those that would perform better, and all that process of tests and checks would simply have become unneeded. This fact should be noted. Now, it is necessary to describe in detail how the experiment itself went, who approved it, who didn't approve it, how procedures were violated, and how the accident developed. For some reason, many sources state that there was one explosion, or two explosions, or a hydrogen explosion, or a non-hydrogen explosion. As of today, it has been absolutely, reliably established, and it must be unambiguously written, that there were 2 consecutive explosions, the second more powerful than the first. Secondly, we cannot talk about the hydrogen explosion without mentioning that in addition to the steam explosion, chemical energy related to interactions between all the molten mass was added. It must be said that all the quantitative assessments show that the power of the explosion was equivalent of around 3 to 4 tons of TNT. Today, this number can be called a reliably established number. 3 or 4 up to 10 tons of TNT. This is the maximum that can be said. By the characteristics of the explosion, by the glow, by the dispersion, it is clear that the system had a volumetric detonation explosion. There was a volumetric detonation. The explosion was volumetric in nature. This means that a rapid expansion of steam, constantly thermally heated, led to the damage that was witnessed. And further, figures of fuel release, they are less clearly known. Then, we must describe the accepted scenario of what happened in the reactor with the fuel. The time when it started heating, the time when it stopped heating, the cooling system, and so on. And it is very important to describe the measures that were taken and their significance. For instance, did a one-day delay in taking action have any effect at all? On the first day, the 26th, except pouring water there at night, nothing was done on the night of the 26th. The dropping of sand, dolomite, clay, started around the 28th. The first drops were, it seems, at the end of the day, on the 27th. All this has to be thoroughly described because it is necessary to precisely write about the physical implication of each action.